So the value at which you deploy the capital is like one of the biggest drivers of how much money you'll make, assuming the thing doesn't go out of business. So from the investor's perspective, like I always want to buy low, and I know that everyone knows that, but like, how do you go about buying low?
And welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Adam Scher from Prosperity Partners. And Adam has had a storied career, and today we're going to take a wander down that path. Along the way, we're going to stop off a founder story that didn't end so well, and we're going to talk a bit about the ZIRP era, how there was easy money, easy pickings to be made, what happened now that we're returned to normal, if you like. And then we're also going to talk about how he's managed to, along with his partners at Prosperity Partners, build a successful firm out of those ashes. And we're going to stop also talking about mergers and acquisitions, negging sales pitches, which is something new for me, but this has got something to do with how you pick up girls currently. We're going to find out about that, but also how you run a startup incubator, maybe. So, Adam, thank you very much for coming along to the show. And maybe just tell us a bit about yourself. Sure. Where are you in the world?
Yeah, I actually don't know much about picking up girls because I married basically the first woman I dated in college. And so I know about one woman a little bit, but
that's all it takes. I'm teasing the audience there a little bit.
I know. But yeah, I'm based outside of Philadelphia. I am our Mid-Atlantic office for Prosperity Partners, although we did just acquire a tax and accounting firm in outside of DC. So the East Coast presence is going, and the main hub where our company operates is out of Chicago.
Fantastic. Just give us we're going to talk about the ZIRP era. But before you fast forward to that, just tell us where you came up and where you go to college and how'd you form the early years of your experience? What sort of background do you have?
Sure. I went to college at Brandeis University, which is a very small liberal arts school outside of Boston. And I studied psychology and economics and thought I was going to do investment banking. So I graduated college in 2007. So that was a very popular time to try to do deals, and there was a lot of mergers. And I actually got my first taste as an intern doing a very small part as an intern doing one of the largest finance mergers, which was the RBS ABM AMRO merger. And I was at a real estate company in their investment banking wing doing a very specific type of analysis that looked at whether the real estate leases were capitalized or operating leases. And so the determination makes a big difference because you either show the debt of the lease or the liability of the lease on the balance sheet or not. And so the motivation was to not show it on the balance sheet to make the net equity look better. And that was a formative experience because I asked one of the managing partners about that. And I said, shouldn't we show it because it's a liability? And I was told I could do the work or go back to America. The internship wasn't in the US. And that was always something that stuck out. And actually in the US, there was some, since then, they've changed some lease accounting rules. So you do create like a right-of-way asset and use liability on the balance sheet. So the accounting rules, not immediately after, you have to lick your wounds if you're the accounting bodies and slowly make changes. But now that would have gone, there wouldn't have been as much discretion and it would have showed up. And I wonder if that would have had a material impact on the deal getting done, which it did. But yeah, I wonder if that would have moved the needle in the other way. So it was the summer of 2007. Perfect timing. Yeah. And interestingly, during that summer, the two of the most prominent hedge funds in real estate, these Bear Stearns Alpha funds went out of business. And so their investments failed in a big way and they had to close down. And so that was another interesting point in when a market turns. And again, this is something I asked some of the partners at this firm. That seems like an important factor. Do you think that's going to affect the market? And they said no. it's, you know, that's a small thing. And in when you're in school, you read, you have limited experience. So you read about basically companies that are at least reported to be like the best and the brightest. So like the, so Bear Stearns, Alpha Funds, from my perspective, were basically like, if you could end up there, you've basically become like one of the masters of the universe, which is one of the investment banking terms of the day. And so from my world, it was like, this is like when genius failed, but in 7-8 years later, and not every, and that turned out to be right, but it is not always obvious at the time. And it's hard to even ask about it, which is why I was told I might have to just go back to America and if I want to keep talking about stuff like that. Anyway, that was a very short part of my career. I then had a stint at Ernst & Young in my first job doing a combination of commercial real estate valuation and audit assist, where you are doing some reasonableness checks on the valuation. And again, you could see that I saw, at least to me, I saw this tension between the values, the pressure to have a not a qualified audit opinion, and in saying, I think things are changing quickly and there should be a revision. And so all of my clients went bankrupt. And so I didn't, there wasn't a lot for me to do after a year there. So I got really lucky and found a local real estate company that was trying to become a private equity fund and have discretionary capital. And so I wrote a white paper about one of the US government programs at the time called the Term Asset Loan Facility, which was an underutilized program, and it remains so, to fund commercial real estate, to fund managers, to keep the market going. And so this company trying to do it, basically I offered to work for free to try to figure out how to make this happen. And so that was my start, and that sort of pivoted my career into sort of private equity and entrepreneurialism. Because in addition to doing that, I was able to sit with the CEO of the company and travel around the country and try to raise money from institutions and individuals. And it took, so this was in 2009, and it took until really around the end of 2011 to 2012 to actually close the first fund. And in the meantime, there were some legacy assets that coming out of the Great Recession had to be restructured. And so that was some other things I've worked on. So there was this multi-year period of doing this financial modeling under great uncertainty and translating that into some negotiations with lenders, existing equity partners in the deal, and then turning this story around to sell to potential investors as a new fund manager that we can do this. And it took several years to get to the other side of that story and raise the first fund and then deploy the capital. And so that was really impactful in seeing how long things take, being able to sit with the CEO through these negotiations. And it's not one conversation or 1 week and done. It sometimes took the better part of a year to get through the process of restructuring a deal, as opposed to in finding a way to continue to turn something bad into something that can generate cash flow.
So you were involved in the stage where you're deploying the capital as well and searching out investment opportunities. And maybe we'll pay off this dating advice line here a little bit about when, because I get calls all the time from investment bankers. First of all, I didn't know what an investment banker was. Someone said to me once, think of them like estate agents. Is that fair? Like you have funds and then you have investment bankers. You weren't investment bankers, but think of them like marketers in the finance world. Is that unfair?
It's a more sales heavy position than I thought. Going into finance and accounting, there was basically a lot of things, a lot of different positions that I didn't know existed. As a student, you know that there's doctors and lawyers, and there's the people you interact with in the service business, so you see those jobs. And then there's more degrees that aren't really obvious, especially in finance and accounting, beyond what taxes have to get done. Yeah, so investment banking was one of them. And when you're reading about the industry, you read about there's these deals that get done. Okay, that's an ambiguous process. There's a lot of financial analysis that gets done. Okay, that I understand. That's okay, sure. So study finance or accounting. But yeah, so it's certainly sales heavy. And I would say it also, you have to, it's like a generalist position, because you need to at some point have analyzed companies in a lot of different industries, You have to have a lot of knowledge about a various amount of industries. And then you have to be able to package this together and tell a story so that the client will choose you to help them raise money or sell the business. And then on the other side, you have to have developed relationships or be able to develop relationships to find the other capital partner to get the thing done. So it's a pretty interesting combination of things that you start at the beginning of your career doing a lot of analytics, market research, and putting together presentations, going into relationship building and sales. So yeah, I think even in working in startups and running my own, I have consistently undervalued the challenge of good salespeople, or not appreciated like great salespeople and the challenge of that. Because you get cold calls, marketing, people trying to sell you or scam you all the time. And I think most people have, I do, like an instinctual revulsion to sales and to people doing it. But in reality, when you need to go make money, like someone has to sell the product, like this stuff doesn't sell itself. And if you have a company and you need to expand.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. I get that because I started off as a programmer and then I realized, well, if I'm going to sell my code, I've got to go and learn how to sell. And then I flipped the switch and I realized, okay. And then, of course, if you're a bad salesperson, it's particularly bad, right? And if you're a good one, it feels so icky. But one thing that happens to me sometimes is I go through a phase, okay, I'm going to take these. Sometimes we're actively looking for investors and we're pitching. Sometimes we're in different phases. We're in operations mode. It's like two different worlds, like running a business. And it's not even a good word for it, but like the funding of that business and the sort of, you know, the building equity in the business and the, you know, building the value of the business itself as opposed to delivering value for its customers. There's two very different mindsets. Yeah. And sometimes people will meet with me and they neg my business a little bit. They say, oh, yeah, you're in SaaS. That's great. Yeah, but what's your churn? Oh, that's a little bit lower than I've heard before. And I walk away feeling bad about myself. So what's going on there, do you think?
Oh, yeah. You know, buying into something in your basis, so the value at which you deploy the capital is like one of the biggest drivers of how much money you'll make, assuming the thing doesn't go out of business. So from the investor's perspective, like I always want to buy low, and I know that everyone knows that, but like, how do you go about buying low? It's okay. So here's James' business. There's growth that checks the box. He's growing 30, 40, 50% a year. He hasn't raised money, so he's capital efficient. So he's mitigated some risk. If I give him money, like I'm probably not going to lose it, but I need to make a lot of money. So one way to do it is if I buy part of his company for a lot less. Some of the common things that have been said to me, probably have been said to you, but also I use in my analysis as an investor is how big, how scalable, how big is the opportunity? So that comes up in total addressable market, TAM, or sellable addressable market. And so I was running, so after that private equity company, I had joined to run as COO and CFO of a SaaS company that did sales and marketing automation in the fitness space. And the company was growing 100% revenue a year and had enterprise clients, which were some of the largest customers in the industry. So to me, like we're number one, we should get the best valuation. We should have people banging down our doors. And they said, health and fitness, that's a small niche. The payments companies are where all of the money is. You're just a CRM. Salesforce is going to eat your lunch anyway. So there's someone else who's bigger. And we like fitness. We get it's a growth industry. You guys are small in all these ways. And yes, I know all these other deals you just quoted me traded at a 5x of revenue with lower annual growth. But we really think you're like a 2.5 to 3x. Ugh, that's a material difference if you're trying to raise what could be several million dollars. That could be 10% of your company, it could be 40% of your company, or in control. And especially if you have multiple founders and you don't own 100% of the company. So that's that. We're talking to you because we have to deploy capital and make a return, but we don't want you to think we have to do this. So there was this book. There's this book that came out sometime around when I was in college or in the early 2000s called The Game by Neil Strauss. And that the whole thing was like about, I actually didn't read the book, but I heard him give an interview it's like you're establishing dominance by making women feel insecure.
Of course, no married men have read the book, right? No one admits to reading the book. So I've heard about it too. Yeah.
No, I did. Right. I said I didn't even date. So I definitely like maybe that's the truth. Then all these other men are just doing.
Sure,
much
me
better
too.
I will take Neil's word. I heard it sold really well. But yeah, it's making them insecure that there aren't going to be other suitors. And so churn is too high. It's the type of churn cohort versus F versus revenue versus logos. So I think there's a lot of ways. And it's tough to know when to push back because you need the growth capital. You're trying to go faster. You might be trying to buy out a partner. So there's some stress in the business you're trying to resolve. And so that's really, so pushing back is really hard. So to the extent, so then basically the two biggest mitigating factors are if you can create a competitive process and bring your own group of people. And that's really something like the reason you would hire an investment banker is because you need this competitive process to get away. And that's where they really represent your interest. If they can bring in 5 or 10 like legitimate potential investors, those investors have to get over the negging game and get much more aggressive in order to get to a close. And in addition to on the price, demonstrate how they can actually close and not just waste your time.
They have a different strategy. They have a different issue, right? So they have to sell how much you could be worth without overstating it. So they're going the other way almost. Oh, this is a great business. I've just sold a business like yours.
Right. So if you, in the SaaS company, we were too small revenue-wise to really utilize investment bankers. So it's hard if your business is under really like $20 or $30 million in revenue. The market is small and disparate. So it's hard to get a competitive bid. When we were talking to bankers, that was something they said, and that wasn't like neg advice. That was real advice. It's like you were under a $10 million revenue company. It's a thin market. We have to charge you more because they need to make fees, but they are pumping up the value. But if you don't use them and you are directly talking to potential investors and inquirers, like you're selling the same story they're selling. Our growth rate is great. This is why our churn is even better than it is against the benchmarks. This is our product pipeline that we're going to deliver that's going to expand wallet share. You're doing all of the same optimistic best case scenarios that you're calling like this is really conservative and pumping yourself up. And then conversely, like you said, when you're running the business, you almost have the opposite approach. You're trying to be capital efficient, not increasing burn more than you have to, following up with individual customers, fretting about small dollar churn, especially early stage. And so there is almost that contradictory mindset you're having.
It's a sales driven sort of setup in the first place, I think. On every trade, there's a winner and there's a buyer, let's say. You're straight away in a negotiation from the first call. I guess if they're calling people, they're looking for the person that says, oh, our churn is low. Oh, I didn't realize. Or it is high, or the market is what's small. Oh, no. And my partner and I are not getting on so well. They're the singles people are looking for, say, okay, maybe there's proprietary deal flow opportunity here to get a good deal. So maybe if you're a business owner, you need to think about what signals you're sending. If you want more interest, maybe it's not so bad if give some of those signals.
It helps. Yeah, it helps to have, and I think this is where like CFOs can help as opposed to like pre-meeting with a banker, even if you use one, because one of the jobs is telling the story internally through the numbers of how the business is doing, how efficient, how successful is the sales team, how efficient is the product team, how quickly do we recoup capital, how are we managing cash? And on the other side, it's how do those present to potential investors? And are they looking at the same thing? Are they placing the same weight on the things you're placing weight on? And if not, what are those things you need to raise to the surface and let the other things come later? And you mentioned churn, that always comes up. So when we're talking about churn, is it even the same way they're talking about churn? So, and I had arguments with potential investors about this. We just didn't see the same way. And in fact, I was telling them we had somewhere between around 10% churn, which was good for the industry. And they were doing this other analysis and thought we had 50% churn. And to a certain extent, you have to say the cash in the bank like proves me right. That's a bad argument because you're basically just saying you don't know what you're doing. But so you have to understand looking at, and sometimes you're wrong. I had a quick aside. I had a client where I was doing some valuation work and working with their CFO. And I just had a brain fart and told them to exclude like a huge amount of wages from cost of goods sold. And I was like, it really should just be like your web hosting services. And it was a total brain fart. And he goes back to his accountant and his accountant writes with five data sources, how wrong I am, pretty politely, but like, he was like, I've never seen the suggestion you just made. And I was like all upset because I've done this before. And so then I click on his links, I'm about to refute them. And then I just pause and I'm like, you know what? I just made a mistake. And so I wrote back and apologized for wasting some people's time and moved on. So sometimes you disagree, but anyway, so going back, so with cohort churn, it's during a given period, say every quarter, you sign up 10 customers or 100 customers. So a year later, how many of those 100 customers are still customers? So that cohort of the period. So that's important to track because during that time, you had a certain sales strategy. You had a certain set of product features. Maybe you had a certain pricing thing. So of those factors and how the company operated, were those in the changes since then effective at maintaining your customers? Or did all or were you sign up your first beta customers and they've all churned? And so you're going to say, so then you need to say, yeah, but you know what? We pivoted the product and we don't even focus on CRM. We do CRM compliance. And so we wouldn't even have those customers anyway. So the churn for that cohort should be ignored, but you have to understand cohort churn. Then you have dollar churn, which is basically from churn, I think the source of truth. It's how much revenue are you keeping and the other things at detail. But at the end of the day, are you maintaining more customers? Are you able to sell more to the same customers? And hopefully not many of them are leaving. And then there's a third way of looking at churn, which is the number of logos or businesses. So that gets at your customer concentration. So are you enterprise heavy? Do you have significant risk or are you a diversified business? And all three of those should be highly correlated, but they are different ways of looking at it. And when you're talking to potential investors, it's important to know which one of those or all of them are they looking at so you don't have this miscommunication like I've had.
Yeah, I have a trick there, which is we use ProfitWell, which is for the SaaS space. So what is a sort of revenue analytics for SaaS companies. And I just log in there and they have a benchmarking session, which is great. And it gives you a nice distribution. And you can just say, when they ask, I go, I mean this, just look up Google how they do it. And this is where we are. And then it shows you like cohort, like in against your companies of similar size or similar industry. And then you're at least, ProfitWell, whatever profit map they're using, you can all agree on that. Might be right or wrong, but at least, okay, they write blog posts about it, and at least it's something. But that can backfire as well, because they can be smarty pants about it. Like you say, a lot of this is a relationship failure. It's like, well, technically, you know, I think you'll find if you look at the definitions, and then that doesn't progress the relationship. And so you've got to pick your battles. I want to get on to, you know, how you've now you do a lot of this M&A work now later with your current firm, but the birth of your firm was interesting and it's related to, again, building, you know, enterprise value or building a business versus serving customers. I'm going to just tell us a bit about how Prosperity Partners was born pre or during the ZIRP era and tell us that story.
I didn't found Prosperity. That was an accounting company. They recently rebranded. It was called NDH Advisors, and they specialized in business accounting, tech companies, high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals. And it's a company I had worked with for almost the last 10 years to do the tax consulting on M&A and business restructurings. And they had been growing steadily over time. And when my hardware startup, I had to wind it down and we weren't successful. I had this relationship with them where they were trying to grow a business valuation and fractional CFO practice and was looking for someone with that direct experience to join them. So my ashes was this nice acqui-hire of basically I had two clients after my hardware company sold in the fractional CFO space that I could bring in and help kickstart this business. But they were very successful, and so successful they had a private equity company invest in them to do a roll-up strategy in the financials account, public accounting space.
Okay, so just so I'm interested there. So you jumped a shark, that's not the right expression. You went over to the operations side on a hardware company,
yep,
working on the finance, yeah, team there. Were you fundraising there?
Yeah, so how that business started, I actually ran, so with the software CRM company, I ran the sales process and sold that company and to a company that went public, and then left there to found this hardware business, which made computer vision, automated line calls, and scorekeeping for tennis. So we'd install this array of cameras on a tennis court, and you had gamify training. And so my co-founders were electrical engineers who invented the IP and a lot of embedded systems and at-scale computer vision experience who also liked tennis. And so my role was that I met them through a startup listserv and saw this prototype. And I'm obsessed with tennis. I tried through various ways for a few years to qualify for the US Open. And I obviously didn't because you've never seen me on TV, but very would spend all my time playing tennis if I could, after family, of course. And so thought that this was an incredible thing to bring to tennis. And so fundraised. So raised like a seed and angel round, basically, and a couple of rounds of fundraising, and then took it upon myself to do everything that wasn't engineering. And so this company, we weren't institutionally funded. And as much as I tried, we weren't a VC business for many of the reasons we talked about. Tennis is a small market, even though there's $6 billion in the US spent, but in maybe the private club space, you have to have too high of a percent of penetration to return enough money for a VC. And maybe we can talk about some of the fund dynamics that people should understand when they hear that. So I was in this angel investor network, my own network, found extended network world of raising capital. And then using my network from the software company, because it was in the fitness space, so there was a lot of tennis facilities to sell this into. And we had the great timing of going into market in February of 2020. And so in March of 2020, 90% of our pre-sales canceled. And so we had an uphill battle in addition to being in a challenging niche before. And there was a leader and first mover in the space that you could look to and say, okay, there is significant money, there's significant innovation, there's some brands, mostly like top high quality colleges, spending money here. And they ran it. And what are we doing to differentiate ourselves, but also realizing some of the struggles they had and recognizing like the space is challenging in great conditions. And then you have where the indoor clubs were all shut down for a long time. That was particularly challenging.
So you took on everything. I mean, when you say you did everything but engineering, that's a big leap, right? So that was sales. That was,
yeah. So business development, demos, closes. One of the engineers and I would do the installations. So we'd ship our hardware out. I would do some in-factory QA, and then we would ship the hardware out, and he and I, his name's Andy, would get up on these ladders or these automated lifts, and we'd be hanging cameras 15 feet in the air at midnight at these facilities because they wouldn't cancel revenue generating hours so that we could install these things that they would cost money. So I'd travel, I'd get these in our, install these cameras, and you're manually up there. And I didn't fall off any ladders, so I was pretty happy about that. But I did get a lift stuck in someone's lawn because these things are like over a ton. And if it's like a little muddy, like you shouldn't drive the lift on the grass. And we had to get a tow truck come, like a car tow truck, to tow this lift out of this person's grass. And they were very nice and humorous about it. And we didn't have to go out of business fixing their lawn. But so yeah, that's the what you have to do when you're basically bootstrapping the business.
Yeah, okay. I like that operational texture there. Not all just in an ivory tower working on a spreadsheet somewhere. You've got to
find all the spiders and stuff.
So now you've come back to a finance role, and Prosperity now has, first of all, rebranded, and you've managed to get, if I heard you right, you say you've managed to attract PE investment in your firm itself. So I want to ask about Prosperity Partners. Sounds like a partnership, but where's the enterprise value in a partnership like that? And why would a PE firm invest if it's kind of times and materials style business, you know?
So some of that is the stickiness of customers. So on the tax side, in high net worth and ultra high net worth, the laws have gotten more complicated. And so you tend to get more work over time, and mm-hmm. you're able to charge more rates. So there's a lot of price inelasticity there. And on the account, the fractional CFO side, so it's high value on the tax side, and it's sticky, low churn, recurring business, even though it's time and materials, but you're able to mark it up at a very good margin, and not so better than like the third, a third. So we're better. We're doing a little better than that. And then on the accounting side, some of that stuff
reference
goes.
We talked about that before we started. Actually, what's the typical third, a third, a third? What you're referencing now?
Oh, so like one of the rules of thumb when you're pricing is you're trying to charge. You're setting your pricing so that the total price of your good is based on one third of the price should reflect your fixed costs, a third of the price should reflect your cost of goods sold, and then a third should be added to generate profit. So, that can work in professional services. It can work if you don't have a lot of admin and you're very efficient with your time utilization, which means you've billed and collected like all of your time. But it doesn't always work like that. And we're lucky to be in a space where you can have a little bit better margins than that. And then on the accounting side, a lot of these on the tax clients are still running their businesses, they're running new businesses, and they know we understand the business. And so we can provide accounting services. And I know some of your other guests have explained this, but I think it is worth repeating. A lot of businesses, when they start and even through $10 or $20 million of revenue, their tax accountant is the accountant / CFO / the person with the numbers. And you don't get the right information out of your financial statements that you need. And because the tax accountant is optimizing to quickly get this done during tax season because they're always too busy. And so they're trying to spend as little time on that as possible. So to the extent the financial statements save a lot of hours, great. But that is often okay at the very early stages of the business. Because there's not very many employees, the founder's involved in all the decisions and has a very good sense for money in and money out. And so it's very accurate in day-to-day cash management. But once you get to $500,000 or $1 million of revenue and you start to have other employees and you have contracts that you're renegotiating or renewing or canceling or changing pricing, your intuition about cash in, cash out can be way off. For example, if you get a large client on a multi-year contract, you might get a huge upfront cash payment, but you income-wise, you have to recognize that over the term of the agreement. And so therefore, if you get this 2 years worth of money upfront, you can't just spend it to do other things because you have to provide 2 years of services. And if you're providing professional services, it means you're paying staff to be there for 2 years. Or if you are providing potentially maintenance and service for some hardware you showed, you have to be able to afford to replace hardware or fly out or hire someone. So suddenly you can become off an existential amount of money. And so then you do need someone on the accounting team who's much more focused on giving you like a real operating picture of the business and helping you make decisions about that.
That's the Pandora's box, right? Because as soon as you do that in revenue recognition, then you're like, hold on, our expenses have a lifetime as well. And we should, for accruing the revenue, then surely we should accrue the expenses as well. And next thing, the reality and the cash situation really go, and that's where you get into, I'm just going to recommend to the listeners, episode 50, I interviewed Clara Aldrin from Unium, and they offer a software that offers revenue recognition. We discussed this a little bit. But then, but then soon you're into, well, then we have debt. Now we have an EBITDA line. And now the dreaded EBITDA discussion comes up about, you know, what Warren Buffett says about that. And suddenly it's not good enough for anyone. Like, okay, it pays your tax, but that's largely what's driving it. Paying your taxes, you get sent to jail if you don't do that. So let's get that right. But then trying to operate your business from these oftentimes you're halfway one and you're halfway the other. And then even the owners, people are doing it. What's happening in the business.
Yeah, I have a client who does some hardware manufacturing for large enterprises. And so they have contracts that take a long time to negotiate and can be valued between $100,000 to a couple million dollars. And they can be 1 year. Some of them have been longer than 1 year. And so for that, when we got started, the CEO was telling me we had X million of dollars of revenue. And I look at the contracts and we do a financial statement analysis, and they had almost a quarter, the real revenue was almost a quarter of that because you had to perform over time. He said, yeah, but we got all this money, and it's not obvious. And that's one of the annoying things about revenue recognition. It's not obvious. Not everything you sold is subject to the same rules. So there was a service component. There was a hardware component. There was a software subscription component. And then there's these thresholds around, are you triggering Nexus for sales tax? And okay, some of this might end up in an overseas facility. Do we have international issues? And so, yeah, that's like you quickly run out of bandwidth from the tax accountant. And unfortunately for the businesses, you always are optimizing on tech and sales. And it is painful, like 100% of the time, to pay up for an experienced CFO or controller, because you need all of this other things to go right to have revenue. But you've created complexity or complications in your business that you actually do need a specialist to understand, but you can't afford to hire one full time, basically. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing you need. We were talking about motivations and, let's say, alignment earlier on and motivations. And this is where you got to realize your tax accountant will do your taxes. That's what he's there for. That's what he's mostly interested in. Your investment banker will have a different set of motivations and want to make the books look a different way. But if you want someone actually running your business, and the good news here is we're talking about all the complexities, but it's a successful SMB. And I always feel like if you make the right fractional CFO hire, that's the most powerful hire you can make. So you're, say, 2 to 10 million in revenue, and you make that hire, you can go from a business which, you know, will survive 10 years and then Peter or whatever, to one that could literally be worth tens or hundreds of millions. Like, it's really a single person. So let's talk a bit about now we had a lot more on the docket, so we could talk a lot about stuff, but I want to get to the section where we talk a bit about who is your chef's kiss customer, in terms of who's your favorite customer, maybe, or who would you like to have 10 more customers just like that, and why?
So this manufacturing client I like a lot because it's a computer vision product whose some of the fundamental hardware was really similar to what I did with my tennis technology company. So personally, I understand what they do in a way that I don't always get the opportunity to with other types of businesses. And so these manufacturing and service component businesses, I like a lot. If they have over $500,000 of revenue, there's complexity there. So you need some advice with inventory management, revenue recognition, investor communication, because unlike my business, these are VC fundable businesses because the TAM is in the hundreds of billions of dollars or more, but they're at this early stage where, again, it's product, it's sales and engineering, and they have enough scale, basically above 500,000 in revenue, where the complexity exists that they need regular expert advice. And in addition to that, some of that should be turned into operating advice. So you have heavy engineering teams. Can we evaluate, like, are you, like, how what is your staffing like? How efficient are you being? How are you measuring that? So the easiest thing to do is everyone can look at sales and see if sales are growing. And if not, you replace your salespeople. But it's harder to look at with your engineering team and even your G&A team. And so we can help you understand that. And I'm not measuring commits, but we do, but I'm able to talk you through like your deployment process, your QA process, who's working on what. And it turned out in the case of this client, we had to prioritize some short-term software development because the team had to basically pivot to go from product development to implementation, like full-time for weeks instead of hypothetically what could be hours. And so your tax accountant doesn't have the time or experience to be able to compile the information to help drive that conversation. And that's what you want your fractional CFO for. And
okay, very good. All right. Now, I love that. We could go down another rabbit hole straight away. My head are ringing because managing an engineering team and connecting them into the finance is just like an overhead charge or whatever. And it's like, it's hard to figure out. But then making down that cost by individual engineers sometimes or what they're actually producing is a massive issue. Yeah.
I was going to say, it also can help if you can sit with the whole engineering team or at least the senior engineers or like the head of product and talk about finances with them because it helps them to understand the business. So at the software company, we were fighting this perpetual battle between tech debt and new features. And one of the biggest challenges of the company was custom development for the enterprise customers, normal product roadmap, and then tech debt because we had like a monolith code base as opposed to microservices. So basically like every startup is a monolith code base because you develop software to get one customer and then you iterate on that. And at some point you can get bigger and try to do this other project to break up your software. And so we would argue with the engineering team about how to get stuff done and how to prioritize it. And so we would basically put together these expected value estimates of the different engineering projects, and we would involve some of the senior engineers and head of product in developing these estimates on expense side and revenue side. So they had to understand how many customers are going to be affected by this product. Is that going to impact churn? Is that going to allow us to charge more? Or is that going to allow us to get customers we can't get? And so as like more of a technical CFO, because I went to get a degree in software engineering after I've been working for a while, it helped get people to think to overlap more in how they looked at business situations. And we certainly still develop software that didn't have the value we thought, but at least everyone had an operating framework and understood why we needed to push in a certain direction. And then how to tell some of these other customers you had to just wait. And that actually relieved a good amount of frustration on the software engineering team as to why we'd always prioritize this or that, and also reduce some of that Monday morning quarterbacking about, oh, we should have just done this anyway. It's like, no, we went through a process and we evaluated doing this. And in this case, it didn't have the impact, which is fine. But you can analyze that as opposed to just kind of flailing it.
Can I ask quickly, how did you actually implement that? Was that like you just gave everyone their budget or a number? Was it done in a spreadsheet? Like, how did you manage the approvals? Was there an approval process in the part?
Well, it was a 50 person company with a 10 or so person engineering team, and the founder and me, and then we had the VP of sales. So we had to understand what parts of the product were being used. So we looked at utilization and which features. And so we said, here's the 99% of basically all the customers use CRM, 50% of the customers use automated texting. And one of our largest customers is asking us to build compliance software for the texting, because if you are a business and you text an individual and they say don't, and then you do it, you can get sued and you always lose. And so it's okay. We have that feature request from one of our three biggest customers. We have technical debt that is a reason we can't, which is when we release software, it either has to be at 3 a.m. So we're minimizing the potential interruption. That's no engineer wants to be up at three. That's like the worst job ever. And then it's like, we could have the second piece of technical debt that would make it a lot easier to develop new features. And then there's the normal product pipeline. So with this compliance thing, it's, we know we have, I forget how many, 10% of the revenue is represented by this feature request that they said is a must have. So churn prevention is that dollar amount. We have five other enterprise customers that represent basically like 60% of total revenue. We need to find out if they have this issue. So then that could be like 60 to 70% of total revenue of is like preventing churn with this feature. Okay, we have this technical debt. That means every time we have a release, we have a risk of taking down the whole product. Okay, so that's 100% of the revenue is affected by that. And are you going to violate your uptime? And so we can say, how long you make stories. We're trying to be an agile development shop. So you make stories. We've broken up the teams. Some people are doing maintenance and we rotate. Some people are doing product features and some people are pinch hitting into the teams based on the current demand. And so we can estimate the workload of the teams and how much the cost and how many customers, and then sales comes in customer support because they're giving us information about churn risk, things people complain about. The salespeople are talking about feedback from demos and lost sales. And so you can put together estimated returns on this work and everyone is speaking the same language. And so there, at least when you resolve a debate, because not everyone always agrees, and sometimes it's on to the executive to just end it and go in a direction, but at least you've made the case, there's an empirical reason, everyone can follow the work, and you go in that direction.
Wow, that's amazing. I have to say, that was quite inside baseball there, but that totally 100% reflects what it's like to run a software business, I'll tell you that much.
And it's messy. It took over a year to really do that. And because you're figuring out how to work within the culture of your company and you need to get buy-in from different people. You have to get people to acknowledge that this is what the issue is. Because if everyone thinks it's something different, you can't then go have this process because they think you're just wasting their time.
And it brings, as an owner, there's a lot of stress involved in, like, there's this finance stuff over here and then there's running the company. And most people are not involved in the finance side of the company. And then, as an owner or someone even on the finance team, you see a decision that's actually very expensive. And no one else knows. They just think, we're hiring a freelancer for this, or we're doing whatever. They're doing their best work, but they have no insight into it. And I love the idea of being able, the whole team be more on the same page. At the end of the day, the money is a scorecard, I guess. And that's the thing that we're trying to push up into the right. And that's what matters. But there's no opportunity in most companies for most employees to have any leverage on that or understanding or anything. And if you can bring it into that conversation, that'll be amazing,
Yeah, I think that's something you can have with small businesses, which is what I work in, under 100 employees. And I don't have experience or know how, if you're a larger company, you can have that sort of ownership. One way is we always offer stock options or profits interest. So at some level, you're financially trying to align people. That's not the same as saying we need to include you in the debate about a strategic step. I do enjoy that a lot about working with small businesses. And I do think one of the biggest challenges of transitioning basically from in-house to fractional is when you're in-house, you can spend a lot of time researching, showing up and talking to people, volleying back and forth between different departments. And in fractional CFO land, like, you're always billing for your time. And so there's a budget and you're like many contractors where the instinct from the business owner is like, I'm hiring you to do this thing. I need you to do it. I need it to be hopefully under budget. And then I need it to be done and delivered. And when you're in fractional CFO land and in other fractional executive lands, that's hard to do because you do need to be able to have, hey, I'm the CFO, you're the client. I'm calling you because I was looking at some other research and it prompted me about conversation we had about your product and adding another product line. I want to talk to, I'm just going to call your head of product and talk to them about it. Or it's like, you know, I don't agree with what you said. So I'm sort of, in my mind, I'm thinking about it a lot, but I have to figure out how to bring that normal business interaction into a much stricter, structured, cost-conscious environment. And I don't have a great answer for that other than to bring it up as a problem. And I tend to be in clients' business about it. And we figure out a way of managing the cost of that. But I do think, so I would say that's probably like the biggest challenge of getting the value out of fractional executives is that push and pull.
I want to ask you who your business hero is and why.
Okay. I like to talk about two people. One is, so earlier I talked about this private equity real estate company that I was basically able to have all these great experiences in. And the CEO of that is Craig Spencer. And I think about a lot of the scenarios I watched him navigate or helped him navigate a lot because we were able to see how he resolved general partner disputes when someone didn't perform in the way they were supposed to over the course of a couple years, but they're a general partner. So it's really hard to change their role in the business, change their ownership in the business, and how those conversations can occur and then resolve in a way where both people actually still work in the business. I think in other scenarios I've seen where you basically are forcing someone to leave, like in co-founders where the
So what's the takeaway? How did I manage this alchemy?
It was data driven and using time. So he was able to bring to the other person's attention that I'm not seeing for whatever reason. Do you need more time? Giving the person other chances. And it's the opposite of the hire slow, fire fast mantra. Did he have every opportunity to succeed? And then this is the last thing, is if you want to be involved, we have to go to this other arrangement. And right. I've been able to use that, and that's been helpful. And also in selling your idea to get capital, this is a paraphrase, but he would say, you have to tell the most aggressive story that's defensible. What are your sales goals, investment returns, et cetera, that are certainly not the base case, but there's data or reasons to say you're not full of shit and you can stand behind it. And I think that's actually really tough because you're like, I think one of the instincts is to try to be fair. And it goes back to that, some of that nagging you get with investors where they say, I don't know about your churn. It's fine. I'll grant you the churn, but we're going to take like retail price and you're doing, and it's no. Like you need to push forward on the sales front on all of those fronts as aggressively as possible because you're selling the vision and then it's on you to execute anyway. And so I think those two things a lot. And then, so then this other person, Seth Klarman, who founded a hedge fund called Baupost Group, he wrote a book called Margin of Safety. So I don't know him, but I read this book and it's about value investing, which being a fractional CFO is not value investing, and being a startup founder is like the opposite of value investing. But one of the main takeaways that he wrote about better than other value investors I've read, like most notably Warren Buffett, is how wrong you can be in your assumptions. And so if you know that going in, like what decisions are you going to make knowing you could be off by 30% or 50%? And so that's one, if I keep that in my head, it helps when I'm making projections or talking about budgets or forecasts. I know I put together a complicated financial model and there's a number that says this is what's going to happen, but that's an estimate. And there's 1,000 assumptions behind it that have big ranges of what's actually going to happen. And so just know to expect it to be different. And even more so in the early stages of the company where you're discovering your product market fit, who your ideal customers are, what your cost of customer acquisition is, what if you're building something, your manufacturing product cost is going to be much higher at low scale than it is high scale. So knowing with that in mind, you should just like, that should always be in the back of your mind. So that's not great.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I think it's a rule about if you have less than 30% of the information, but more than 70% of the information, you've either waited too long or jumped too early. And yeah. And you know, if you have all the information, then you know, you probably, it's priced in by someone else already. So what's the point? You gotta just know that afterwards. And then with that attitude, you're like, okay, I'm just aware. I don't know all of this. And then you just, and then maybe that the lesson from that maybe is you got to keep taking shots on goal, right? You can't, you know that all each decision is fallible, and you just got to trust that the averages are going to work out.
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Adam, this was great. This was a longer interview than I normally do, but that's because it was so in depth and I got really good at the end there. Especially, you know, if you're wondering what it's like to run a software company, this is Adam hit it bang on the head, especially on the expenses side. You know, I couldn't say it more perfectly. And I want to thank you for listening. If you're still listening now and you are a fractional CFO, part of the reason that I'm doing this is you go to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've recorded a webinar there about how, let me start this one with Ben. So Ben is a fractional CFO who works with us and our software. And the reason he uses us is that he goes in, you know, he sorts out our GL, he does cash flow projections, and then he gets to the budgeting process. And then if he goes through the budgeting process, and what used to happen is it was like sat on the shelf. Everyone knew there was a budget. There was some big thing. They would take it out like afterwards and see what happened. And now what he does is he uses Procurement Express to deploy that budget within the organization. So he puts a name against each budget item, and each person is able to log in and see what their portion of the budget means. And what I'm even more excited about is a little bit, I didn't expect you to touch on this, is, but you're able to match those spent that expense against KPIs. For example, we were talking about an engineering team, some of the story points or whatever. That means when the head of engineering is hiring that contractor, is even just signing off on the wages, he then has to put in what the value delivered was that against. And there's even that process of having to do that. Okay, I spent 50 grand this month on engineering. How many story points did I deliver? Just that process of having to put it in, even if that guess, like you alluded to, sometimes is wrong. Oh, great, we knocked down 6,000 points of technical debt. Very hard to measure that. But just the process of doing that starts to connect that engineering manager with the financial story of the business. And you can do that in each department. So some people say, oh, you can't manage, you know, the expenses in a SaaS business. It's just engineering and marketing and there's nothing else you can do. It's not like they have pieces, but it's a total belief that is not true. If you bring the team into the financial conversation, you can use Procurement Express to help you do that. So go to procurementexpress.com/partners. Got a whole webinar there. It also goes over how not only what we do, but how I believe fractional CFOs can demonstrate their value faster than they normally do when they go into a place. So I hope you enjoy that. Adam, this has been great. This has been a surprising one. I was expecting to enjoy it, but we got a bonus there at the end. I really enjoyed the details. So thanks very much for coming on.
Yeah, I have one follow-up on the ICP. So we have our own clients that I mentioned, but with our private equity partner, our other ideal client is these value, like these high value professional service accounting companies, which is like fractional CFO is certainly one of them, business valuation and business tax. So for us, we are also looking to grow based on that. And the firm and our sponsor, Unity Partners, does a great job of identifying teams that are ready to integrate into a larger organization that uses technology to the greatest extent possible and believes like with an employee ownership model. So I thought that's unusual. Most of the ICPs are businesses and we have the second important driver of the company.
So just to clarify that for a second. So if you are a fractional CFO, you're working with a client who has potential for some sort of PE deal, you also...
No, the business of the fractional CFO, like your other guests who are running their own practices, those businesses.
Appreciate you coming on. Thanks very much.
This was a lot of fun too. Thanks, James.